Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 123, with guests, regular of the show, J.R. Forresteros, from the Norval Rogers site and the Don't Split Up podcast. Also, first-time guest, a contributor at Christ and Pop Culture, Jessica Gibson. So listen up, because we've got a really excellent show for you this time. On this episode, we talk Moana and the importance of the journey.
Hey, great to finally be on with you guys.
I know, it's pretty exciting. I was just listening to some Moana soundtrack to get myself all pumped up.
Nice, yep, I've been doing that. I legitimately haven't. It's been on and off that and the Hamilton mixtape ever since the two of them came out.
Nice.
So I have not, I know I have technically heard something from Hamilton because I saw like an award show or something. So I don't even know if it was like the real song or it was some kind of mashup of different songs. But
right.
I've intentionally avoided listening to Hamilton stuff because, one, I think I'm going to like it a lot and I'm going to need to listen to it, and I don't have a lot of time to listen to things and I need to listen to podcasts instead. Number two, I really want to see it when I actually see some version of the play.
Right.
Like, I don't want to hear the music without the play. I don't know.
It's hard. So I live in New York, and so I have an equal number, not an equal number. I have a couple of friends that have seen it, and of the group of them, there's, you know, a pretty even mix between people who, you know, were obsessed with the cast album and listened to it all the time and then saw the show, and people who avoided the cast album and saw the show, and both groups love it equally. And in fact, I've heard from people who just obsessed with the cast album say that going and seeing the show only made it better. They don't feel like there was any kind of detraction, and that they actually enjoyed finding the differences seeing it live versus just listening to it and imagining it. So that's, I'm a massive Hamilton nerd, so I'm always in favor of somebody listening to Hamilton. I may be biased is what I'm saying here.
I say that's as much of an endorsement as anyone I think could probably give to someone who is, I think, rationally trying to hold out. But like I said, I really want to. As a pointless history major, I'm like, they finally. I mean, it's like getting to watch like 1776, except I'm assuming it's way better. So
it's better. I mean, 1776 is hard to beat, but Hamilton is better than 1776. I gotta say. But when you do listen to it, make sure that you give yourself like an uninterrupted 2.5 hours to get through the whole thing, a road trip or something, because you just got. You gotta do it all in one.
How long is it?
Kind of experience. It's about 2.5 hours.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Where am I going to get two and a half hours?
Road trip.
I don't get to road trip very much anymore.
Mikey, if you were to, for instance, visit Dallas.
To drive somewhere in the country.
Like off the top of my head.
But just spitballing here.
Yeah.
Just spitballing.
I sense an old conversation.
Oh. So I know that I've got JR for a semi-limited time because he's getting ready to go explore not having responsibility for a week or so.
I actually have a little more time than I thought because my wife works until 8, so.
Oh, okay. Well, what time? See, now you're making me do math, like adjusting times.
It's okay. Just don't worry about it. Let's just do our thing.
Just don't worry about it.
Yeah. Don't stress.
You're an hour behind, right, JR?
Yes, I'm in Central Time.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
So I was planning on doing Moana, and then lots of people were excited about talking about Moana, and I was fairly excited just like watching the previews. And I have a man crush on The Rock, like every other sane
like
male
every human. On the planet. Right. Yeah, naturally.
You know, like, who else can make me want to go see Baywatch? The Rock can.
No one. The Rock, literally.
Literally, The Rock. I mean, they could maybe put Idris Elba in it, even though he doesn't really have the same mantra for it, but I'd still go see it because I would assume maybe he's being a lifeguard. He's running into the ocean and then like a Jaeger comes out of the ocean. I would hope for something like that. But
isn't that just Pacific Rim 2? right?
I'm fine with that.
Isn't that just the plot?
I don't even care if they're like, wait, didn't you die? And everyone's like, yeah, we can't explain it. He's just back. Okay.
That's good with me. Well, I mean,
he's just going to come up out of the water and everybody's going to just accept it.
Yeah.
Can you imagine like the Jaegers like running underwater to like the Baywatch theme in slow motion, you know?
I mean, if Jaegers are on screen, I want the Pacific Rim theme because that song was awesome.
Well, it's awesome, but you're messing up the picture.
Sure.
I hear you. I'm just saying like...
Yeah, it's hard to be.
Well, Tom Morello guitar solo speak to my soul in a way few other musicals.
So I'm sitting there going, I'm going to watch this movie no matter what. The animation looks beautiful. I can't imagine Disney's going to, you know, screw this up. I go see the movie. I was like, oh, that's a perfectly good movie. And I get out and I'm ready to talk to people about it. And honestly, I don't know if I'm just hanging around unsavory characters or what, but honestly, I could not find a whole lot of people who actually went to see this movie.
Really?
And it kind of seemed, and besides a song or two, I don't really hear a lot of people talking about it. People were like, oh, that came out. It was really cool. And I like that song that was like, these things.
And you must be running in different circles because I know a ton of people who saw it and are still listening to music. And yeah. Well, it's crazy.
So I guess that's what I'm kind of curious about to start because, you know, JR said, I know you said you liked it. And Jessica, when we kind of finally went back and forth to try to find a movie that you wanted to talk about, you were like, oh yeah, that's, you know, I would definitely love to talk about that. I'm like, well, I found two people that are really excited and I found no one else who's even seen the movie. Really? So I'm kind of curious. I feel like some of the criticism leveled against this movie was that it was kind of like, oh, it's the same old story. Nothing new happened. It just has a cool setting. So I feel like you guys would probably disagree with that on some level. And you're both on Skype. So ladies first, what would you say, Jessica, sets this apart from other Disney movies?
Well, I think people that have been saying that it seems like a retread of stuff Disney has done before are not completely wrong, because part of what makes Disney movies work is they do have a pretty specific formula that they kind of just change the variables for.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference is, so I think it's not a totally unwarranted criticism, and it is something that I actually had the thought of when I first saw it as well, that like, okay, this is, for the most part, is pretty standard Disney fare. I think what sets Moana apart are the very subtle but significant ways that it is different from the Disney formula or from the standard young heroine formula that we're used to. So the first is the obvious one. There's no love interest, which is different for Disney movies. I know people want to say, well, there was not really a love interest in Frozen. I'm like, okay, well, one of the main characters had two love interests, so yeah. That kind of balances out, okay? So that's an obvious way, but it does make a very significant difference for the way that the main character as a young woman behaves and the kinds of interactions that she has when she is freed from the narrative expectations or the narrative consequences of having even a potential romantic relationship, much less an actually fulfilled romantic relationship. And we could go into that, but that's a long conversation. So that was, I think, a subtle but significant difference for me. And there are several others that I picked up on. I went with a group of my friends. I'm in film school right now, and I went with a group of my friends. We all got to go to a screening of it early. And so we were also having lots of conversations about it from a filmmaking standpoint. And so they were helping me pick up on things that I don't think I would have noticed had I just gone to see it casually. So some of these things are, for example, the way that her hair is animated is a weird little detail, but it's really significant. There's a couple of times throughout the movie where she's got to pull she's got this beautiful, long, curly, crazy hair, that was just gorgeous. And it was animated. It was sopping wet when it needed to be sopping wet, and it didn't always look perfect. She had to pull it up into a bun to make it practical a lot of the times. And there are many, many points in which she like whips her head around really fast and her hair comes all the way around and slaps her in the front of the face. And I'm just like, I've never seen that in a Disney princess quote unquote movie. I've never seen somebody's hair behave like that ever before.
Elsa never had these problems.
Elsa never had these these problems. Her hair, like, actually clipped through her arm at one point. It was, you know, all the animation was to make sure her hair looked good. All the animation in Moana's hair was to make it look normal. And that's a weird thing. I know that's a really weird little thing, but that's the kind of thing that, sitting as a young woman in the audience, I look at and I go, nice, I relate to that. That's awesome. She's not, they're not pretending that she's some kind of especially refined or especially perfected character. It's even better, I think, than like true narrative flaws, which she had many. She had a bunch of really great rounding out personality traits, but it's those like little physical touches to the animation that subtly, those build up on each other. These subtle things build up on each other in the audience's mind to tear down a lot of the misogynistic expectations that they could have of Disney heroines. These things all, they're small, but they run counter to those small, insidious other things that we've come to expect. And it was that constant pattern of these unexpected counterings that I came away with most strongly. And I know it's subtle, but I think it was really effective and I really appreciated it.
Mm. So I guess this is a good point, a good time to point out, because this is your first time on the show, Jessica, that we will spoil the entire movie for people. So you don't have to at any point worry about giving anything away.
Good to know. Good to know.
So, and for listeners, just in case.
About the ending then.
Oh yeah, so if you want to keep going, because I want to ask you a couple questions about some of the things that you mentioned.
Yeah, cool. I have one more thing then about the ending, which I wasn't going to say because I didn't want to spoil it, but mm-hmm. Now that I'm free, we're going to go for this.
Yeah, you have a long way to go? I don't know, whatever.
I know how far I'll go.
That's...
Oh, boom. There we go. Yeah, I got it, I nailed it, nailed the landing. No, so the ending was very, very powerful for me. And I have a lot of thoughts on this, but my primary one is that it was the act of Moana giving the heart of Tafiti, I believe was the goddess's name, giving mm-hmm. Tafiti her heart back and healing her. And that her Moana's whole thing was that after she kind of felt confident in her own identity, she used that confidence and she used that newfound strength to help somebody else, specifically another woman, recover her identity. And that healing, life-giving act. I've written a little bit about this before, actually, in the context of Mad Max Fury Road. I wrote a piece for Christ in Pop Culture about it's a very long explanation, so I'm sorry if anybody gets confused as I try and do this quickly. I think it's a very biblically sound, uniquely feminine thing for women to be life givers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw that in the end of Moana, where like her heroic act is healing and giving life and creating identity for somebody else, which is an effect. It's a narrative beat. It's very effective. I think speaking as a woman and a woman of faith, it's especially effective for that to be the heroic beat for a woman and for that to be the thing that the whole movie was building up towards, this idea of, you know, finding your identity, staying true to your beliefs, and then using that to help other people, to help somebody else have the same accomplishment. That was really powerful to me. And again, kind of a subtle thing that I think stands out in the broader scope of Disney heroines, you know, finding true love and, you know, accomplishing somebody like their expectations as a princess. Like those aren't bad things, but this is just different enough in a really empowering way, that I came away from the film just kind of blown away that they did that.
Mm. And so I'm hearing you talk about the importance it is to visually see or just narratively hear that women are life givers and how important that is to you as a woman. And the first thing I think about is one of those things where I'm like, am I reading too much into the film or is it all kind of just setting itself up so perfect? But I'm thinking, well, then how does it fit or is it fitting that Maui is the one who tried to steal the heart of Tafiti? Because he wanted to take the ability to create life and give it to someone else.
Yeah, I don't doubt that that's intentional. I bet that they did that on purpose.
Mm.
Yeah.
So Well, actually, you know what? I'm going to give JR a turn to answer, and then I'm going to come back to something else you said, because I'm pretty sure that he's going to have some thoughts on it as well. So, JR, you're still there, right?
I am.
You just eating your popcorn?
No, I'm just enjoying the conversation. I'm enjoying listening.
So I'm kind of curious, when you came out of Moana, to you, what made this movie stand apart from other Disney films?
Other than the Coconut Pirates?
Other than the Coconut Pirates.
No, I mean, one, as Jessica said, there was still love interest in Frozen. And it was hailed, rightfully so, that at least the end of the movie wasn't you get married, fall in love, and live happily ever after. Mm-hmm. But that was still a pretty major motivation for one of the characters, at least. And it was fun to see Frozen subvert that, but it was even more fun to see a story about a young woman who comes into her own and discovers her identity and her place among her people, and a man just has nothing to do with it at all. It was awesome to see that her parents weren't even prodding her to get married and settle down. Her grandmother wasn't asking, when am I going to get some great grandbabies? Like, it just wasn't a thing. And it was also not assumed that she wasn't going to have those things at some point. It just wasn't essential to her personhood and to her becoming an adult.
Which is one of the weirdest things to me, because if like they had the window, like they didn't even have to make it like a plot point. Like, they didn't have to be like, oh, you need to leave the island so you don't have to marry like stupid guy next in line to be the king with you. They were like, they just completely went a different direction. No one cared.
That's exactly right. And so I thought that was just tremendously good. Like, what a great message to send to girls who want to look up to Moana, that you becoming you doesn't have anything to do with another person outside of yourself. Like, you need to figure that out. We could take it into the spiritual realm and talk about like the spiritual connection that we have to God. Sure. But it's not, you don't need another person to complete you. You're not a broken half person looking for your soulmate or any of that kind of stuff. And it was wonderful to see that, similarly to Frozen, but also in a substantially different enough way to be really enjoyable. I think it also matters like a ton that Moana does not look anything at all like any of the Disney princesses who have come before. Even in The Princess and the Frog, her skin was black, but her features were pretty European. And it was awesome to see a Hawaiian princess who looked Hawaiian. And again, at no point was that even commented on. She just, they told a Hawaiian story that had a Hawaiian lead. Her features didn't look like every other Disney princess that we've had. And so it was just awesome for me to think about so many young kids being able to watch this movie and see themselves in a Disney movie in a way that they never have been able to see that before. And it made me really excited. And then beyond that, the movie was just a ton of fun. I had a blast with it. The music was great. It was just a great fun movie. And I just to reiterate what Jessica said, seeing at the end of the film, the resolution being something completely other than, if you go back to like Sleeping Beauty, right? And the evil female character who has been driving the plot of the film, becoming a dragon and having to be slain by the man. Like, you couldn't get more opposite from that, from what we got in Moana. So it was great.
We'll break that down. Like, sit there for a second and break that down, because I think the point that both of you are making is you're mentioning something, and we do assume that people have seen the movie, but you just went through Sleeping Beauty and said like, this is the character, this is what happens. So what is happening, and like, how is it subverting at every turn?
So in Sleeping Beauty, you have the old, powerful, female character who is threatened by the youth and beauty of the protagonist, Sleeping Beauty. And at the end of the film, Maleficent, and I should say this too, Sleeping Beauty is one of my all-time favorite Disney movies. I love Sleeping Beauty, particularly because of the end sequence. I found it terrifying as a kid. I think it's super fun to watch now. But in that, the Maleficent transforms into a literal monster, a big old dragon, and attacks, and Sleeping Beauty has to not only be wakened from the sleep of death by her prince, but then saved from the dragon. It's the classic Princess in the Tower story. And so the only, you know, there's lots of literature about how in a lot of particularly mythic tales, the only roles that are available for women are either virginal princess or wicked old queen. And Disney movies are case in point of that. If you just kind of look through a few, you've got either Cruella de Vil or Snow White, right? I mean, that's kind of the... And so in Moana, you have the setup for that. You have this virginal princess and this wicked old goddess. But what we actually learn at the end of the film is that there's been this deep trauma that has happened specifically because of the character we all thought was the knight. And rather than him swooping in and saving the day, he runs away. And the princess has to figure out how to solve this by herself, more or less. Now, again, they kind of work together in the end, right? But mm-hmm. but certainly not in the same way that we, you know, yeah. He's certainly not, you know, slaying the dragon and saving her. And that's what we're all anticipating, is that somehow they're going to defeat this evil monster. And what happens instead is Moana extends a talisman of power to her. And we find out that this evil monster is actually the person that they've been seeking all along. She's just been warped by trauma. And so by Moana extending friendship to her instead of hatred and suspicion, she is transformed. Then she is healed. She is rescued by the princess. And so rather than this like competitiveness that we see among women in most films and most literature, there's this beautiful community that happens. And again, the byproduct of that then is life and healing and hope, not just for the two of them, but then for all of Moana's people. And in theory, we could extrapolate and say for the whole world. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what really stuck out to me when I was trying to come away from the film with some general idea of what stood out to me. I feel like some of the stuff there, like I didn't have to see the movie to know that it was going to be different. I didn't really feel like I had to see the movie to know that Moana looked different, that she looked more like a real person. I mean, she's still obviously like beautiful, you know, like she's not like an outcast socially or anything like that. But she has features that are non-typical Disney. She is obviously the empowered-ish female to some degree that, like I said, I could tell from the trailer. So I'm like, what would surprise me from the film? What would I not be looking for? And I think the idea that at the end of a film, we don't see the bad guy being overcome with violence. We don't see the bad guy or bad girl, whatever, being overcome by being like thrown down or deposed or cast out, but actually brought in to something, and basically surrender being used, or friendship or forgiveness or reconciliation, because then that leads to more reconciliation. The Teka, who they assume is like this lava witch monster thing, ends up being Tafiti, and then Tafiti, instead of being like, I'm so mad at you, Maui, that you stole my heart and made me this lava monster for, you know, undisclosed amounts of time, Tafiti actually turns around and then rewards Maui. And that, I don't know, it's just like this beautiful scene of like reconciliation, begetting forgiveness, begetting like friendship, begetting restoration. And I'm like, oh, well, I mean, that's a little bit different, right?
I think it matters. I mean, if you look at the archetypal stuff that's going on in most Disney films, this feels dramatically different, mm-hmm. In like some pretty fundamental ways. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when people said it's just more of the same, I was like, you mean it's animated and has music in it? Like, I don't know what you mean. This is so different in some deep, deep, deep ways that I think are way more important than the superficial similarities.
Well, so Jessica, you you said something that I'd kind of thought earlier, which was even if some of the criticism is right, even if it is similar, if it is just the basic hero's journey, is it even bad if it's mostly the same? I mean, like, what is Moana doing that is actually like other Disney movies that you liked to see on screen? You know, is it just the music? Is it just the pretty animation?
No, but pretty animation helps. Like, just pause and take a quick, like, 2-second detour to say this is one of the most beautiful and stunning and colorful movies Disney has ever made.
Mm-hmm. And creative. I mean, the parts where you had, this is going to sound super weird. Or maybe not. Maybe you had the same experience I did. The parts where they were mixing two styles of animation, mm-hmm. and you had the quote unquote real animated characters inhabiting these like storytelling worlds that were a flatter kind of animation. Like, it actually made the characters feel more real to me,
mm-hmm.
because they were living in an animated world.
Yeah, it made it all. It was just so vibrant at every turn. And yeah, having the alternate animation styles helped to emphasize the places where it was especially bright and vibrant. So yeah, it was gorgeous. Okay, sidetrack over.
I think that's right on topic. I mean, like I said, what is Disney doing that Disney does best that we see in Moana? Mm. You know, mm. not to discount, like, you know, it's not that Moana does everything different. Like I said, I think we've established that they do a number of things the same, but what are those things and why are they still good?
Yeah, I think so. It is really hard to go wrong with the hero's journey. And I know that there are a lot of people out there who would want to criticize it, but I think I know that the reason we still tell hero's journey stories is that hero's journey stories still work. They still, they work. They influence us. We feel it. And that's just innate in us. That's one of the most basic primal storytelling formats that we as this planet full of humans know. And that's why we keep telling it over and over and over again, is because it will always have a pull for us. And this idea that we can start with feeling confused and lost and we can feel like our world is coming down around us, and go from that to feeling empowered and accomplished and we've actually saved our own world, like that's always gonna work for us. And I think Disney does the hero's journey spectacularly well. That's almost the thing that they do best. And their best films kind of follow this formula. So I think, I don't think it's a detriment that this is a standard hero's journey formula.
Well, can we stop there for just a second? Because I think the three of us who, I mean, we have film school and we have two people who have podcasts that deal oftentimes either directly with film or with film a lot. So I think we're throwing around the idea of hero's journey. Like, we might have people listening who, aren't familiar with Joseph Campbell or anything like that. Can you give people, like, the outline of the hero's journey?
Put your hands on your ears, because you're about to have your minds blown.
I mean, yeah, just, like I said, just the general outline so they can see how, oh, yeah, I see this all the time.
Yeah, JR, go for it.
Okay, so Star Wars.
Yes, Joseph Campbell, that's the first thing.
Yeah. So Joseph Campbell is a scholar. He came up with this idea of the hero's journey, which is a template that you can sort of set on top of just about every really great story ever told and see how it's functioning. Star Wars is like a really, I assume most people have seen Star Wars. And so it's a really easy one. So it's a ordinary person, Luke Skywalker, just working on a moisture farm, who has a sense that there's something wrong in the world, or that they don't fit, or that they were, you know, meant for something more. And they are called out of the ordinary world that they inhabit to go on a journey or a quest. And they usually have an older mentor who comes along beside them. So that would be Obi-Wan or later Yoda. And this mentor gives them some sort of talisman or power. So in Luke's case, it's both. He gets a lightsaber and he is trained in the Force. And then he goes back into the ordinary world that he came out of, which is, of course, this galaxy oppressed by an evil empire. And the talisman that he has received enables him to succeed in some way. So Luke uses the Force to shoot the torpedo into the exhaust port on the Death Star and blow it up. Spoilers for Star Wars Episode 4. So that's the basic hero's journey, is that ordinary person called into the special world, meets a mentor, receives a talisman or some kind of a power that enables them to go back into the ordinary world. And so you see that in Moana, right? She's called out of the ordinary world. She meets Maui. She receives this talisman, which is the Heart of the Sea. And through that, she's able to save her people and go back to her island and stop all of the rot and all of that.
Hmm. So you just got learned, people. You just got learned.
Google it. It's really cool. You can do all kinds of stuff with the hero's journey.
Yeah, there's lots of people who've talked about it. We have mentioned it on the show before, but I feel like it's never been a specific criticism of a film enough where I wanted to make sure that we could almost not negate the criticism, but kind of level the playing field against a particular type of criticism. Especially when we're talking about how it does the same thing that lots of other Disney movies do, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Not just Disney movies. I mean,
yeah, basically. It's
difficult to find a movie that is sort of, there's like indie films that kind of play with narrative. But if you're looking at most basic movies that you enjoy and find satisfying, it's probably got a hero's journey in it pretty close to the surface.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So we completely tangent, and I apologize, Jessica. So continue. I'm sure you were just in the middle of a thought. Just keep going.
Not really. No, it was just that, the hero's journey works. And I guess the only thing that I would want to add, because I have seen this particular criticism leveled at Moana, which I think is an interesting thing that the number of critics all of a sudden find the hero's journey formula in the context of Moana to have been predictable and dull. And I don't want to leap right away and say, oh, that's misogyny driving that. And they don't want to see a girl go through the hero's journey. I think that's a bit extreme. So I'm not going to dive straight to that. But I do think it is something to consider when talking about a movie like Moana that takes a standard story format but just changes the players around a little bit. And then people are all of a sudden, no, you changed too much and now it doesn't work. And you changed it in a specific way and that doesn't make it work. Because I think that's the what's beautiful and best about something like the idea of a hero's journey archetype, where you can take the standard 1, 2, 3 and then play with it and fill in the blanks with things that are going to make it interesting and new and different. Like, that's the purpose of archetypes, is to give us something traditional and familiar and compelling to hang our hats on, but then we fill in the blanks and fill in color in those lines with things that are going to change our perspective a little bit and give us some new context and new ideas about the way that archetype can work. So I think Disney did a very good job taking that archetype that works very well, that Disney does very well, and then coloring in the lines with something different.
I think that's really well said. I mean, if we strive so much to have things that people can't relate to, it seems almost redundant, but how can people relate to it? Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you see in a lot of indie film that's experimenting with narrative. And in many ways, the point of making the film is to try to push the boundaries of how we tell stories. Mm-hmm. That's not what Disney's doing. Right. I mean, they're not experimenting with the boundaries of how we craft narratives. They're wanting to tell really compelling stories. And the best way to do that is to stick to a formula that, as Jessica said, is like pretty much in our DNA.
Yeah, well, that's what I'd say. I mean, the hero's journey, I want to say, is it's like hardwired into us. So we can try to run away from it, or we can try to be too cool for school or whatever. But like, ultimately, there's a reason that the hero's journey works so often. There's a reason that it, above almost any other narrative style, connects with us almost instantly and then can compel us to be on the hero's side or put ourselves in the hero's place and get on board thematically with what's going on in the story. If it wasn't hard-coded on us somehow, then I don't think it would work so easily. I don't think people would go to it. And we could talk we could talk for quite a while about how, yes, there are people who try to subvert general narrative theme, and they often do it. And there's a couple directors who, you know, don't really even believe in telling linear stories or hero's journeys or anything like that. And I would say that, sure, you can probably find an example here and there of indie films or kind of off the wall directors who succeed in this. But I would say that if you watch all the films that are made that try to do that, it's a lot less common that people will connect with those films. Like you would be like 1 in 10, as opposed to 9 out of 10 films that use the hero journey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and not to, like I said, not to diss indie films or people who are trying to subvert that genre. I think it's awesome. And like JR said, one of the greatest things about art and about telling stories is try to tell stories in new and compelling and just interesting ways to look at it from some other way that you've never looked at it before, to connect with a person who may not connect with it in another way. So that's not that there's not value in that, but when you're talking about telling a story, I mean, because Disney's about making money. Disney wants to tell a story that as many people can connect with as possible, while also being compelling in some way. And they're going to find the most bang for their buck sticking to what's worked for them for a long time. In most cases, I would say. So there's something that I wanted to round us back to, and it's something that you said, Jessica, when you admitted that even though Moana does not really play with any of the ideas that most female princess movies do, there's not technically anything wrong with a lot of those things. There's nothing wrong with falling in love. There's nothing wrong with wanting to wear a pretty dress. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be in charge, or things that we've seen 100 times in films. But it seems like Moana specifically, like both of you said now, doesn't try to argue against those things as much as it doesn't even focus on those things at all. And we all seem to be in general agreement that it's a pretty good thing for Moana, but is it great that we see none of that in Moana, or do we see a little bit of that, or is it important that it didn't have any of it because we just don't see films that don't do anything like that? Does that kind of make sense? Like, because JR mentioned, because I feel like I'm confusing myself. JR mentioned like how the Princess and the Frog, oh, we see, you know, someone who's not just like a white European, but even though her skin is black, she basically looks European, and she's still being called a princess. And we still see some of these things, even though it's a little bit different. Moana almost changes the entire story. Is it important because we just never see it, or is it important because Moana kind of ignores it to begin with?
JR, go first. I'm gathering my thoughts.
I mean, I think it's really great that we can just have a story that doesn't have any of that, and it works, and it doesn't feel like anything's missing, and it doesn't feel like some executive somewhere was like, make sure there's no pretty dresses in it. Like, they just told a great story about a compelling main character and about a great, rich supporting cast. It had great music, it had great animation, and it was what it was. And we still have Beauty and the Beast too.
So, because they never go out of their way to actually bash any of those other things.
No, it's just not there. And so, I mean, I didn't miss it. I wasn't ever, I mean, at no point was I ever like, oh, geez, I wonder if she's going to, at one point I got a little nervous. They were going to go all Twilight with a super old demigod hooking up with a preteen. But they didn't. Like, they steadfastly didn't. And it was great. It was a better story for it.
Yeah, I think now, almost now more than ever, it's really important to show that stories that are different and that play with our expectations in these creative and empowering ways do work, and they can work, and they can be super effective. Like, I know this is slightly off topic, but we're seeing it just this past weekend where Hidden Figures beat Rogue One at the box office. You know, I think that just that kind of thing is really important. And I think Moana fits in this trend of showing that you can take away some of what you think is necessary for a story like that to work. Mm-hmm. And the story still works and, in fact, is better in certain ways and is better at telling certain stories because it is missing a lot of those traditional elements. I think that's really important because once you open the door for one kind of diversity or one kind of difference, that's enough that the next kind of difference, the next kind of diversity has more room to step in and be like, I'm also here. I'm also worth paying attention to. So every step in that direction, every step showing how stories can be different, and how many different kinds of stories can get told, every step in that direction, I think, is progress.
Mm. And I think something we were talking about possibly before the show, I'm not exactly sure when the show is going to start, but is we were talking about like the divide, especially like with politics and agendas and things like that. And I feel like when a movie does something that certain people disagree with, the instant idea is they look for a movie that doesn't just not do that, but it argues against that as completely wrong. And the thing that I love about Moana is that it's neither saying, like, hey, a movie where we don't follow princess tropes is the best, and it's not saying, you know, princess tropes are the worst. It's just saying, this is who she is, and she's interesting. Don't you want to know what she does? And it's,
well, there was that one moment, right, where he keeps, like, Maui keeps wanting to call her a princess, and she gets mad. She's like, I'm not a princess. Like, we all know she's a princess.
I kind of love to see, like teasing themselves a little bit over that.
Right, the, right,
cause
right.
Because you've got to know that this is going to be the primary conversation around the movie. Is like, is this really a princess movie? So I appreciated that little nudge.
I wanted
to just add on to that, Mikey, real quick, something that JR said earlier, that the movie never precludes that Moana won't have any of those traditional things. It's just not relevant right now. It's just not relevant to this story. And I think that's a very important distinction to make for, you know, if we're going to put this up and discuss it as a feminist film, that's a very important distinction to make, that those alternatives, those possibilities in her future are not wrong or are not valid. They're just not current. They're just not part of this particular
story. And I think
it's important.
And I think certainly we could probably extrapolate it's really likely that she's going to, you know, marry and have children based on like sort of the social structure that we see in her community. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just not part of this story. And okay, great. Like, why does it have to be, you know?
Well, I think that's the thing. I think I have spent so much time on Facebook and Twitter that the understanding is that if you're not for something, if you're against one thing, then you have to be this other thing that does not necessarily include all the things that you may or may not believe. And like I said, that's where I find myself a lot of times in social situations or social media situations. Heck, even sometimes when we have discussions on our discussion board, or I have conversations about a specific movie and someone's like, oh, this movie said that it was against this thing. I was like, well, not really. The movie just said that this thing wasn't good, but it never said this other thing was better. It just said that, you know, it's not taking a stance automatically because it struck out as something. And I, like I said, maybe it's a small thing. Maybe it's just resonating with me more than anything, because I feel like so many films where they're, I want to say agenda because it makes me sound like I'm like a Hollywood weary kind of guy. But like, I realize that, I mean, when people pour their hearts and souls into making a film, they usually have a story they're trying to tell, which means they usually have some kind of narrative or theme or something they're either working out personally or trying to work out to get through to the audience. And a lot of times now, I don't know if because they think audiences are dumb, which we could argue is maybe a true statement or not, but like they kind of wear it on their sleeve, and it's refreshing to be like, hey, her journey is more important than something that you see or don't see. And like I said, it's refreshing to me. And as much as this film didn't blow me away, like it didn't, like I was like, oh, I'm going to watch this film 100 times. It wasn't like that for me. You know, I had a lot of fun, but I never felt like it was trying to be a thing or make a statement. I felt like it was just trying to tell a story that was interesting. Whether it's a story we've heard 100 times before or not, because hero's journey, et cetera, et cetera. So I do want to change gears a little bit because we haven't really mentioned this at all. And I do preface this by saying I feel like there's a lot of ways this could go because there's some direct allegory, there's some comparisons we can make, but then there's an overarching question that I think whether you're a Christian or not, I think you ask yourself. And it's when during the film, there's a worthwhile question that kind of Maui asks at one point. And he basically doesn't understand why the ocean, depicted as living water, you know, not, mm-hmm. not heavy. Well, not, you know, they're probably doing it, not direct allegory, but depicted as living water, and powerful and vast and expansive, doesn't just complete the task of returning the heart itself. He doesn't understand why Moana is picked. And so I'm interested in, cause I know my thoughts and it's kind of my show. So I don't really have to answer the questions. I bring smart people on to answer them for me. I'm curious. I'm curious of two things. One, why does the ocean pick Moana? And two, what kind of symbolism do we not have to dig too deep to see there?
Can I be a little bit terrible and actually answer in counter of the first question?
Yes.
Yes.
Which is that I think it's actually pretty cool that we don't ever really find out why the ocean picked Moana. And that's kind of the point. I think that's kind of the point of that whole narrative arc there, that Moana was just chosen. And the reasons behind being chosen don't really matter after it becomes important, after the action that she needs to accomplish becomes important. Like the reason of why behind all of it fades out in the light of the significance of what she needs to do. And I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful example of that Moana provides us of somebody who kind of goes in faith without really knowing why or knowing what the ultimate purpose of it is going to be, but she starts on the journey anyway. And she obviously goes through periods of doubt, and she has a struggle there before the final confrontation where she loses faith and she loses hope, and she has, mm-hmm. She lets herself start questioning her own ability. And then her faith is restored by the people around her. And at the end of the film, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm forgetting something in the movie, but I don't think the movie ever answered the question of why the ocean picked Moana specifically. Like, there wasn't anything inherent in her that made her the chosen one, quote unquote, but she was still the right person for the job. And she stepped into being the hero that the story needed. So I think from the perspective of a believer, that's a really great template for us to work with. You know, it's not a perfect template. No story is going to be the perfect template, but I think it's a really great template to work with, where for as long as we're here on Earth, we're not going to know why we're chosen or what the ultimate purpose behind that is, but we still need to go in faith. We need to recognize that we're going to have periods of doubt, but we can have hope that there will be people around us to build us up in those times. And that despite the doubt, despite the uncertainty, going in faith means following it, you know, seeing it through, following it to its final end, and doing our best in the face of all the challenges that we come across, despite not really knowing. That's what I took away from it. So mm-hmm. I hope that doesn't like throw off your questions too greatly. But
no, that's actually great, because if they explained why they picked Moana specifically in the film. Again, I'm with you. I missed it. So when I ask that question, I ask it with the the whole intent of you just going where you feel with the question, because like I said, I don't think they explicitly say, and in fact, I think it's actually great that they don't explicitly say, because it actually feeds into a narrative that I think is explicitly more Christian than one that culture would probably give us in, you know, in most cases.
Mm. I was struck by, I guess, again, treating, you know, the story was told as a myth.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly, you know, the it wasn't clear that the island they were on was an island of Hawaii, though Maui's name is Maui, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so what I was struck by, and this is very tangential to your question, but it intersects at least, was that, you know, we are formed by the Hebrew scriptures. And in the Hebrew scriptures, the sea is an enemy of Yahweh and Yahweh's people. You know, it's embodied as a Leviathan, and it's a place of danger. And so it was fascinating to see the sea personified as a benevolent force, one that is working with Moana and Maui, one that is seeking the healing of the land. I was struck by how, well, again, since I know nothing about any sort of Polynesian mythologies, I was just struck by that, by how radically differently they view the ocean than the ancient Near Easterners, who obviously, because of our scriptures, we're more familiar with.
So I guess what I'm curious about is if we were to take the question, like, why does the ocean pick Moana? We can actually compare the ocean a little on the nose to God, because I think this is a question we get a lot, which is if God is all powerful, if God, the living water, is powerful and vast and covers everything that we can see or have ever known, you know, at least in comparison, what does it need, or what does God need with us? Why not just do everything himself? If he's so powerful, why doesn't he just fix the problems? Why doesn't the ocean, like, again, why doesn't the ocean, since the ocean knows where the heart is, and the ocean obviously knows where the heart needs to go, why doesn't the ocean just take the heart there? And like I said, I think it raises fundamental questions that everyone wants to know. The why am I here? What is my purpose? I think it raises the question that most people who are skeptical to a God, a living and active God, would ask. Where is God? If he's here, why doesn't he just do X, Y, and Z? And then if he was even here and could do X, Y, and Z, why would he give a crap about me? And I really like what the film Avenger said over at the site. And he said it reminding him a lot of 1 Corinthians 1, when Paul kind of commends, like, you know, brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not, to nullify the things that are, so that none may boast before him. And while, Jessica, I think you pointed out very rightfully that this, what we see in Moana, what we see with the ocean, is obviously not a one-for-one to the Christian faith and any of the analogies we could offer, it does remind me, especially in these funny little situations where she does step out in faith to follow something that calls her on this journey for reasons that we don't understand. Because she needs it, it seems. She needs to be pushed. She needs the encouragement. And when she doubts, the ocean's still there. The ocean's still helping her. Like, I love the way that that Maui keeps knocking Moana off. You know, he keeps depositing her overboard in various ways, and the ocean will not let her go. It will not let her fail. It keeps putting her back on her journey. And like I said, I know it's not one for one, but it's interesting to me how you can take a Polynesian myth and you can see these threads of truth through all kinds of myth throughout all of history. It, like I said, it's beautiful to me. So that's kind of why I asked that question. Because I'm curious how it's resonating with you. I'm curious, what do you, you know, what were you thinking people could take away from it? Is it just funny? Is the ocean simply there for comic relief, for physical comedy? I mean, cause it does work. Or is it maybe a little bit more? So I guess unless either of you have anything else to say about that, I'm kind of curious. I wanted to open it up a little bit to
I guess one thing I would say about the reason the ocean requires Moana, and it's the same reason I think God uses us, is because it's more about our need to grow and to flourish than God's need for help. And so the ocean could have handled everything just fine, but it was about what Moana needed and the person that Moana needed to become. And in a way too, it was a calling her whole people back to who they had been before they became afraid. Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So if the ocean had just handled things, they never would have left the island. And yet what the ocean desired for them was to be back on the ocean with the ocean. Like, that was where they were the most fully the people that they had been. And that was when the ocean was also the most content, we can assume. Right?
Oh, my gosh. And you didn't tell me to cover my ears because my mind is being blown, JR.
No, that got so real so fast, man.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, if you want to connect all the dots all the way back to the scriptures, like, God installed humanity as God's images in the creation. And we, out of fear, out of suspicion, out of distrust of God, gave that away. And basically the whole story of the scriptures is God calling us back to our rightful place as stewards of creation alongside God. So that by the end of the scriptures, of course, you get heaven and earth reunited, and you have the garden that has now become a city, and the tree of life is in the middle of it, and the living water is flowing through the city, and humanity is living with God as God's images, as God's faithful stewards of God's creation. And I think that's metaphorically what you see in Moana.
I'm actually getting this picture of Moana's parents, Chief, what is it? Tui, basically his entire argument now with this new revelation strikes me as he's on a deserted island, being like he is Israel in the desert, you know, wanting to collect manna and say, look at the coconut tree. We have everything we need. We can, you know, we can sustain ourselves. We don't need to be back on the ocean where we have to trust the ocean to provide for us. Metaphors. They're blowing my mind.
Yeah. Wow.
So God needs us, God calls us because God knows who we were created to be.
Mm-hmm.
And God stubbornly insists that we be that.
What a jerk. What a jerk.
It's like those little like self-care posts that are like, aggressively believes in you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it is.
Well, now that we've all had our minds sufficiently blown by this silly little non-descript, nothing new, Disney cookie cutter movie.
Disney.
Yeah. I want to open it up to you guys. Is there anything else that stands out to you about the film that is worth discussing right now?
Besides the Coconut Pirates?
Oh,
the Coconut Pirates, man.
Coconut Pirates, I feel like anything I say after that whole breakdown there is just going to be ridiculous. So I'll just run through a couple of quick ones. If anybody hasn't seen the behind-the-scenes footage of Alan Tudyk voicing Hey Hey, the Funny Chicken, where he makes chicken noises for about 10 minutes and then ends the clip going with this just defeated look on his face. He says, "I went to Juilliard," and that's the end of the clip. If you haven't seen it, you need to see that, because it's great. And I feel like it was good background for the character of Hey Hey, honestly.
amazing.
It's great. You should look it up. But in all seriousness, I think the only other thing that just struck me so much is the soundtrack and the music. And this might just be my innate bias towards all things Lin-Manuel Miranda, but I loved all the songs. I think people who don't like the Crab song are wrong. It's great. Everything, wrong. All the music is great.
I didn't love the Crab song. Wrong. Thank you for letting me know that.
Well, you're wrong.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
So I had a special note in my show notes that said at some point I am going to say that I did not leave the theater saying, "Oh man, I was blown away by that music." And honestly, I couldn't remember almost any of it, except for the fact that I remember that there was like a song that I'd heard before about people on the ocean, and I couldn't even remember what it was called. And then there was one where the rock raps, which I love because the rock did it, not because it was especially like great necessarily.
Right. But just because it was the rock.
Yeah, because he made it great, because he's the rock.
Right.
But the song that I actually legitimately liked was the Shiny song.
Yes,
I was like, that's the song that I liked. And I don't even really like David Bowie a whole lot. Not that I don't like David Bowie, just to be clear, but like I'm not like spinning David Bowie records all the time, but I was like, I get it, I see it, and I love Jermaine, so it was great. Favorite song, easily.
Awesome.
Boom, done. Boom.
I didn't love it. That's okay. I'm really glad you both loved it. Like that, I'm glad to be outnumbered.
Well, as I've stated earlier, JR, if you don't agree with what I say, then obviously you are wrong about all the things that you think.
Yeah.
Because that's
been really nice being on this podcast.
I'm glad we could have this conversation.
Yeah.
What did you like, JR?
What do you mean, like in general?
Well, what song did you like the movie? Well,
I mean, I liked her. I am Moana song.
This is your first radio. Just explore the space, man.
Yeah, whatever. I like most of the songs. I'm not like re-singing them or listening to the soundtrack. But it was fun. It was good music. I was tapping my toe. So, thankfully, I don't think I'm going to be hearing any of the songs in my house the way I've heard Let It Go so much. So,
wait, why are you hearing Let It Go all the time?
I mean, literally, just everywhere you go, you can't get away from it. Maybe it's because I live in suburbia, but
I thought you meant like literally someone in your house is playing the song all the time, and I'm just like,
well, I do live with two toddlers, and they learned how to use our Google Home, so now they'll just walk up to it and go, "Hey, Google, play Frozen." Yeah, there's no way to tell it, "Don't listen to toddlers." Like, it's not, the technology hasn't evolved that far yet.
Come on, Google.
Yeah, seriously, that was a huge oversight.
It's like the new kind of child protection software.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, except it's like parent protection software. It's like, protect us from Frozen.
From the children.
What that is you have a whole bunch of millennials, which I don't have a problem with, but a whole bunch of millennials at Google all created this amazing thing, and they all took it home, and none of them have kids. And so when they product tested it, they were like, "I see no problems with this. Everything seems perfect. I can see no way anyone would ever do anything annoying with Google Home." They needed some more product testing.
To be fair, I try constantly to think of annoying things to do with Google Home. But I'm an adult and I feel like it's my right.
That's why you make the big bucks.
Yeah. Hey, Google, tell me a joke. That's my favorite one.
And it does, right?
Oh, yeah. And they're terrible. It's amazing.
Like, terribly amazing, or it's amazing because it sucks at telling jokes and it thinks it's good?
Well, my wife, Amanda, is the queen of puns, and it has yet to tell her one that doesn't send her into a giggling fit. So.
Excellent. So yeah. This episode's been brought to you by Google Home. It hasn't really, but if Google, you'd like to sponsor this episode, just give me a call or an email, or you know how to contact me. You're Google. You'd already know everything about me. So,
although technically, if this is going to be sponsored by Google, we should be using Google Hangouts, not Skype.
What I am?
I
what
tell
we are
that all the time.
We are using Google Hangouts. What are you talking about? Why would I use something else besides Google? Google, I love you. I please just give me money.
It was a joke, Google, I swear.
I just want to be shiny. So Jessica, tell me the two or three things about Moana that you just love the most. Like, even if you've already mentioned it, like, accentuate it, because I feel like you've said a number of things that you really like, but like that sit at the top of your Moana mountain.
Her hair, for sure. I'm not kidding. That was the first conversation I had when we came out of the movie, as I grabbed my friend and was like, did you see her hair? It was, I don't know why it just was important to me, but it was. So that's probably number one. The reprise. So just in terms of moments, the reprise of How Far I'll Go, the song, towards the end of the movie, where she is speaking with her grandmother's spirit right at the end, and the end of the song, the climax of the song, is her just standing on the bow of her ship with the memory and the power of her people behind her, and she just announces her name to the whole ocean. That's just a great moment. Anyway, you slice it. That's just great. So that's gonna be number two. And number three, I really, really, we haven't talked about this yet, but I really liked the character of Maui. And not just because it was The Rock. Having it be The Rock was like a huge, huge perk, but I really, really liked the character of Maui. And I'm going to go off on this just for a second, because, you know, it's one thing to have a movie with a very powerful female lead. And it's another thing to have a movie with a very powerful female lead who has a character counterpart that supports her journey and supports her story in such a meaningful and encouraging way. I just think that adds so much to the hero's journey, if you will, of the main character. And so having Maui be a character that undergoes his own emotional arc, who is very fleshed out, well-rounded, and makes mistakes, has victories, and supports Moana the whole, like, she obviously doesn't support her the whole time, but he comes around to it. You know, they're buddies.
He Han Solos. It's all right.
He Han Solos. He does. And that whole, even that to me was just a wonderful progression for the character. I really, really liked the character of Maui. I did.
I second all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I really like the fact that it was hard for me to tell about halfway through the film if they were only using The Rock for bravado for this Maui character, because it was totally working. It totally fit.
Like, you couldn't see past The Rock to critically analyze the film.
Yeah, it was tough for a while. Actually, I would say this: when he first got on screen and first started doing stuff, I actually didn't like it, because I love The Rock so much that I could only see The Rock. I couldn't actually see Maui as a character. But I feel like we're using the word journey a lot, and probably because it fits. But the journey that Maui goes on, character wise, like he becomes less The Rock and more Maui throughout the film, which I think is, like I said, unfortunate that I couldn't see anything but The Rock at first, but remarkable in the fact that I stopped seeing The Rock at some point and just saw Maui. And I think that really happens the further and further into the story we go, and we see Maui actually, you know, when he drops some of the bravado, when he actually is remorseful and he's like, I legit was trying to do this 'cause I thought it was the right thing. and I messed up and I didn't know how to fix it. And once we get that part of him, I am like, wow, I actually really, really like this character a lot. Which makes it even better when he Han Solos, like I said. But it was tough at first because, you know, everywhere I go, I see The Rock. I'm like, hey, it's The Rock in Fast and the Furious. Hey, it's The Rock in Central Intelligence. Hey, it's The Rock with, what is it, Sean William Scott in this random movie that's still funny somehow. Hey, it's The Rock. He's dressed like a tooth fairy. Why am I watching this movie? Oh, yeah, because I love The Rock. So that was fun.
That's great.
Well,
I honestly didn't have that problem. I actually I pretty quickly got lost in Maui.
Well, I guess you're just better than the rest of us.
No, I watch fewer The Rock movies.
That would make you worse than the rest of us.
That's what I'm saying. There's a couple of ways that could go.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
I haven't seen The Tooth Fairy.
Why not?
Oh, that's a pity.
It's surprisingly amusing.
It's pretty good actually.
So, all right. I mean, like, you know, you have to understand what you're getting yourself into.
I'm not sure I do.
Yeah, well, don't have unreasonable expectations about anyone. Okay, I'm going to make sure that nobody at my school listens to this because I'm going to get a lot of crap from this. It will be bad. But, you know, just understand what you're getting into. Don't have unreasonable expectations. And yeah, it's a pretty fun ride. It's fine.
Look, the fact that this man has so much charisma that he can dress up like a tooth fairy and you're not like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen, but you're kind of like, man, The Rock can do anything.
What's the one where he plays a football player and he ends up having, he's taking care of his daughter and he has to go to ballet class or something? I'm totally getting off topic, but that's one of my favorite Rock movies of all time. I don't remember the name of it. I just remember the performance and the story. Like, yeah, it stays. Yeah.
No, I've seen that one too.
You're not talking about Ballers, are you?
No.
No.
Oh my gosh. So I know what you're talking about. Cause whenever I say The Tooth Fairy, I get those two movies mixed up because
they're very similar.
Yeah. Cause they're very similar. And that's the thing.
And The Rock is in a tutu in both of them.
Exactly. Because he's The Rock and he doesn't have any, you know, any craps to give for lack of a better phrasing.
Yeah, that's true.
Gosh, he just makes everything better. Even like he makes good things.
Is that the plot of G.I. Joe 2?
Basically. So the first G.I. Joe movie is awful. Like it's a terrible, terrible movie and a complete waste of time. But G.I. Joe 2, yeah, The Rock, it's still not a great movie, but you're kind of like, I can watch this.
It's better. It's bearable.
Yeah. The Fast and the Furious franchise was basically a waste of time to me. And then he came along in Fast 5, and now it's one of my favorite action franchises. I mean, they fundamentally became different movies when he got into those films.
Are you all aware that San Andreas 2 is in production?
Well, did you see how much money San Andreas 1 made?
Yeah, but like, what?
Did it really do that well? I'm going to be so, I can feel it coming on. I have these moments where just movies as an entire art form lets me so far down. Did San Andreas 2 really do?
No,
do
it did really well.
It did really come well. It
struck gold because it did what so many films try to do. San Andreas came out at a time of the year when, for some reason, nothing similar was out for like a month. Like there were no big action movies out for like a month.
So it's the only thing?
Yeah, plus The Rock, plus, like, I want to say it came out like in early March or something like that.
It was right before the summer rush, which is normally a formula for failure.
Yeah, exactly. But there was nothing else out. Everyone loves The Rock because they're humans and they breathe air. And it just made a ton of money. Let me take that back. It didn't make a ton of money. It just made a decent box office the first week, and then it had no competition the next week, and no competition the next week. Because I remember it was right when we started playing our fantasy movie league, and I was like, well, I'm not picking it this week, because there's no way people are going to still see San Andreas, because it's San Andreas, right? And every week, it was just like in the top three. And it was just sticking around.
And it was not good.
Oh, no, it was not good.
My household loved it. An inordinate amount. I'm going to get yelled at for saying how bad it was when they listened to this episode.
Well, I think that goes back to what Jessica's saying. I think if you don't have unrealistic expectations and you kind of know what you're getting into, like, I enjoyed things about San Andreas, like The Rock. I was like, hey, look, it's what the Day After Tomorrow, whatever it is.
yep.
Except with The Rock in it instead of John Cusack or whatever. So, this is better. That's an upgrade. I mean, I really like John Cusack, but, you know, he's not The Rock. So
yeah, The Day After Tomorrow could have benefited from The Rock, for sure.
So I'm like, okay, I get that. I can see how they pitch this, you know? But I think the idea of a San Andreas 2 doesn't upset me because they're making a money that's obviously a cash grab. I think it's curious to me because it basically goes back to the very first conversation we had on this episode where you don't care if Idris Elba's character shows back up in Pacific Rim 2, even though he died. You don't care. Don't ask about it. San Andreas fell into the ocean. How do you have a San Andreas 2? There's nothing left. It's all gone. You know, like what is your 2? You know,
that's what I'm asking. I'm like, yeah, the whole movie was about California falling off and sinking.
Yo, you know what? Hollywood finds a way, man.
Yeah. They just
Hollywood finds a way.
Yeah. They move San Andreas to the mountains.
California is all of a sudden in space.
That's right.
What if this is a surprise Aquaman crossover to set up for Shazam?
Then it could be. Well, if it wasn't DC, then it could be the best movie pitch I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Well, hold on to the space theory here, because this could be the crossover with Pacific Rim 2, where California falls into the space portal that's in the sea and ends up in space. Like,
I love it. I'm there. Well,
that could happen.
That's the Cloverfield movie coming out at the end of this year.
Oh, it is the Cloverfield
it's
movie.
All connected.
Oh, gosh.
J.J. Abrams is even smarter than we thought.
Somehow Star Wars figures into it the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love how the last 15 minutes of this episode was basically us just doing an outtake, and I love it.
Disney, if you need writers for Moana to San Andreas 3, we're there, obviously. Yeah. Yeah.
We're just connecting the dots. We've already established your cinematic universe. We're just waiting for you to get on board.
Yeah, come on. What's taking them so long?
Well, with that, I will officially wind us down. I feel like we've done some favorite moments. I feel like we've done some cleanup. So I will just double check and say, Jessica, this is where I would give each guest a chance to give their final thoughts. Anything that you want to say about this film that you have not already, be it a recommendation or just a commendation, anything about the film that you want, an idea that you want people to leave people with?
I don't. I feel really good. I think we've covered pretty much all the bases. I definitely feel like I've gotten a chance to give my thoughts. So thank you guys. But yeah, listeners, go see Moana. I don't know if it's still in theaters where you are, but if it is, go see it. It's great.
Excellent. Excellent. JR, same thing, man. What can you leave people with?
Yeah, I just don't understand how someone wouldn't like this movie. So if you didn't, please let me know why not. And if you haven't seen it yet, I think there's lots of worse movies out that you could see right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think like both of the DC films that came out last year are on DVD. So you could end up watching those. Don't do that to yourself. Like, watch Moana instead.
Oh, I love the tangential power of this episode. It's been a blast. I want to say that I really was blown away by the animation in this film. Like, I mean, the year started for me animation wise with Zootopia, and I said, this world is amazing. On the episode that we had about Zootopia, one of the things I kept coming back to was the animation was so good that I really was immersed in this world they created. So that moved on to Kubo. And honestly, if it wasn't for Kubo, which to be fair is a different type of animation, then Moana would have been my visually favorite animated movie. But I think we were really treated and treated well in 2016. I mean, because even though I didn't really think Finding Dory was all that great, it still looked great. So I think we're in for a treat.
Did you see Finding Dory?
I did.
I mean, you could see what was happening in the movie because all I could see was basically like a black screen with some vague shadows moving in darkness. Because it was so dark all the time in that movie, is what I'm saying.
I think I saw it late at night, so maybe the theater was dark, and so the screen was. I don't know.
Did we talk about the Coconut Pirates yet? Man, those things were amazing.
You already had your chance, JR. I just laughed
so hard the whole time they were on screen. It was awesome. Such a great sequence.
Well, that's the thing. Why didn't they come back for something? Why would you have something like that and not, like...
They did the George Costanza. They left you wanting more.
If we gotta knock Moana for something, we gotta knock them for the lack of follow-up Coconut Pirates.
Disney, so, if you're listening, they'll feature heavily in San Andreas 3/Moana 2.
When Namor, actually, what is he in? Which one's which?
Namor is in Marvel.
Okay,
he's the Submariner.
Would this be a?
Yeah, that's right.
Would we want this to be a DC film, or do we want it to be good? It's Disney, so it's got to be a Marvel film.
Well, The Rock is already attached.
Can we just backtrack for that for a minute? Because I think we're just glossing over the fact that what just came out of Mikey's mouth was, do we want it to be a DC film, or do we want it to be good?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all on board.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, I can feel that burn from here, man.
Well, do you disagree with that burn? Do we need to have another tangent?
No, I'm good. I'm good. I just wanted to let you know. Okay. Like, there's a fire you're starting here.
I just wanted to slip it in there. I wanted to keep moving. And I wanted it to be something maybe someone who reviews the episode points out. But now,
Mikey,
it's out of front. I'm sorry. I just appreciated it so much.
How do you feel that The Rock is already attached to a DC property?
So this goes back to our Rock conversation. No matter how bad DC is or how much they try to ruin something The Rock is in, The Rock is going to rock the hell out of it, and I'm going to enjoy it. So
I hope it's more like a Ryan Reynolds Deadpool thing. Like, Fox really had started to ruin mutants pretty good, mm-hmm. and Ryan Reynolds, like, single-handedly made Deadpool what it is. So I'm hoping that The Rock will single-handedly make Black Adam awesome.
Because he wants to do it so much?
Yeah, because he wants to do it so much.
Yeah. I can see. Well, like I said, it's hard for me to imagine The Rock stepping into any character and not making that movie or that character in that movie instantly better than it should have ever been. And especially since he obviously really wants to do it, then it's possible. So
the moral of that story is those Coconut Pirates ruled.
Well, that's the thing. I'm afraid the Coconut Pirates are going to be minions. Maybe they won't do that. Maybe they don't need...
No, nothing will ever be as bad as the minions.
That's why they weren't in the movie more, Mikey. So they don't become minions.
I sure hope not. If they show up in San Andreas 2, the search for Moana 2 in space, Cloverfield, then I am going to be very disappointed because that's what started DreamWorks, or was it DreamWorks, right? Down the dark path?
Yeah. Mm. Yep. That was the moment. That was the beginning.
Huh. I don't know. That's what I want to say. Something about animation. Yeah, it was good. It's pretty. Water looks amazing. I can't imagine what they do with water these days in animation. I think it's silly how good it looks. So, that's a thought. I think that's my final thought. So, how about this? Amazingly tangential conversations happen because we have amazingly tangential guests. Also amazing guests.
Sorry.
The whole goal of this moderately structured podcast is to have a conversation like you would actually have a conversation when you're sitting around your apartment on a Friday night being a loser with your friends, which is what I like to think I would do with the rest of my life, be a loser. So I love the fact that we got people who wanted to have tangents. I love the fact that we talked about this movie. I love the fact that we talked about a movie who people have been kind of meh on, at least in my circles. I'm glad it's not been in y'all circles.
Apparently, it's just North Carolina.
Apparently, just North Carolina again.
That's it.
And well, that's the thing. Almost go to the Facebook discussion group, and I think you will see that it has, you know, people aren't like, oh, Moana. Because it's not the Brady. I don't know. It doesn't matter. So anyway, I've really, really, really enjoyed this conversation. I hope the listeners have too. And I want to give the listeners a chance to follow what you guys are doing. Jessica, how can people either follow you, your opinions, or any work you do around the web?
The best place for that is Twitter. My Twitter handle is @GibbyTOD. It's GIBBYTOD. There is a story behind that handle, but, you know, it does need to happen. Don't need to get into it right now. But that's where I'm at most often. I'm currently writing for Christ and Pop Culture. So anything that I do in the near future will be there. I'm, you know, hoping to branch out to other places. I'm a freelancer, so I'll be all over the place. But I'm also in film school, so, you know, writing kind of takes back seat now and again. But yeah, Twitter, that's where to keep up with me, @GibbyTOD.
Nice, and that'll definitely be in the show notes. JR, if people somehow don't know how to find your work on the web already, how can they do that?
I blog and podcast at NorvalRogers.com. That's Shaggy from Scooby-Doo's real name, if you can't find it.
That's amazing.
And, yeah, thank you. I have several podcasts there. I have a feminist theology podcast. I have a horror film podcast. I have like a Bible study podcast. And then my main podcast is Storymen. And by the time this episode is up, by Friday, we're doing a massive 150th supersized episode on the new film Silence from Martin Scorsese. And so we have interviews with graphic artist Gene Yang, artist Mako Fujimura, an investor on the film, theologian, Japanese medieval historian, just kind of giving some context to that. So we're really excited about that. And that's all at storymen.us.
Yeah, so especially by the time this episode hits, that will already be out, so please go check it out. The link to all JR stuff, the link to all Jessica stuff will be in the show notes, which you can find at realworldtheology.com. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Find all our work, again, at realworldtheology.com. Join us on Facebook. You can search Real World Theology and find our discussion group. And as always, please do not forget to subscribe to the podcast. The more of you who subscribe to the podcast and rate and review the show, help other people find the show and join the conversation. And heck, we really enjoy having more people involved in the conversation because it's just more fun, more opinions, more views, more perspectives. So for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
I mean, I speak for a living, so it makes me feel better that you like my voice.
Oh, I mean, I guess most people don't really like the sound of their voice all that much. You know, maybe except for that dude who says, "Let's get ready to run." You know, that guy, he probably likes the sound of his voice. But
I don't know. He has to say that specific thing so often, and it's only the one thing. He probably hates the sound of it.
He hates when he shows up to a party and everyone's like, well, "Are you ready? Are you ready? I'm ready."
So I checked, and Alan Tudyk did go to Juilliard, but he left in 1996 before earning a degree. So that's why he's doing chicken voices.
That's why he's doing chicken voices.
That's why he's doing chicken voices.
Wow. Explains everything.
It does. We have hills. We have flat places. You know, it's like it's like a little microcosm of the geography of the whole United States.
The whole country.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not, you know, the mountains aren't Rockies tall, but they're good mountains. The beaches aren't like Florida beaches, but they're, you know, solid beaches.
We have the best mountains. They're really tremendous mountains.
The tremendous. The mountains in Texas are tremendous. I have people calling me all the
Everyone
time.
Everyone says we have the best mountains.
Oh, God, it hurts to laugh.
Yeah, we laugh so we don't cry. That's right. If there's one thing that you take away from this conversation, Mikey, it's that those coconut pirates were so freaking great.
That's all. The end.
That's it.
Done.
That's all I wanted to say.